Another announcement?
Okay, gotcha. All right, gotcha. I just want to say I'm thankful to God that I don't have to look at her for 4 years. I'll take whatever I can get in the last days. Okay, for announcements, deacons meeting, this is the week for it. We'll follow. We need to provide meals for a couple in the church. We also would like volunteers who could help and be able to go to their house to help this woman physically. It's Linda Bettner, you all know. Big secret. I've got to hide this. And we're sorry for any inconvenience, finally, but the CD recorder in the media room is demon-possessed. It does not like the CDs and spits them out immediately. So there will be a delay in the getting your CDs to you. We'll try to work on it this afternoon and see if we can fix it. Otherwise, we'll have to get a new one probably. Okay. Huh? Oh, see Terry about the Linda Bettner helping her with meals and that. Okay, sorry. Okay. We are ready for verse 15 here in Colossians 1. Again, I don't want to say we take it for granted, but it becomes, yeah, I know that. But it's a phenomenal thing. To contemplate that in 3 hours, and 3 hours only, Jesus Christ paid for the entire sins of the human race. I mean, if it was 24 hours, it'd still be phenomenal. But it was just three. 3 hours, which he paid for the sins of the world, and he was a pincushion and under the wrath of God, cut off from God, could not even call on God in prayer. Any believer can call on God, and no matter how bad the circumstances, even if you put yourself in a bad situation, you have rebound, you have the ability to call on God. We've studied this over and over again. Entire civilizations could be forgiven of their sins. The Assyrians were, and they got a lease on life. And they were down to about, I don't know, I remember it was something like 30 or 40 days. That's all they had left, and God is going to put the hammer down on the Assyrian civilization. And in comes Mr. Good Attitude Jonah. And they turned to the Lord, and they turned away from their evil, and they repented in sackcloth and ashes, from the king all the way down. You don't see that. I mean, that is like, where else have you seen that one? You see individuals, yes, the Jews in their history, get themselves in a fix, turn to God, he calls the dogs off, forgives them, and starts defeating their enemies. The period of the judges, for example. And he would heal this country, but this country won't be healed. All of its problems, we think, are political and physical. They're spiritual. And there's a God to deal with. If we just cleaned up everything with regard to all the craziness that we do, you know, got out of these bad treaties we're tied up with that our presidents have put on us and the elite have put on us, NAFTA, now this new one they're trying to, hopefully it'll die, and all this other craziness, you know, even if all that could be corrected, even if, we still have a God to deal with for all of our crimes and sins. These can be forgiven of individuals, of course, and of whole civilizations. Israel will be forgiven at the second advent in connection with the coming of Christ when they start turning to the Lord right and left in spite of all of their awfulness, their uncleanness among the nations, the stuff they have put off. So for the individual, no matter how bad it is, there is forgiveness. There is forgiveness of sins. The unpardonable sin, as documented, is rejection of Christ. That's the only sin of which there is no forgiveness in this life or in the one to come. So we have forgiveness of sins. We have been emancipated from the slave market of sin. We were like people, like someone say, born into slavery, born into the institution, if you will. We've been emancipated from that. And the purchase price is the blood of Christ. That's the coin of the realm. That's the price that had to be paid. And the essence of God is holiness, His righteousness, was completely placated by the work of Christ on the cross. So all people of all times, any place, in any situation, can have forgiveness for all the sins, however many or however egregious they may be. And this is what we tell people. You can get off the hook, you can get out from under the condemnation that hangs over everybody. That sentence is not carried out until the person dies in unbelief. All right, now we're going to begin to deal with, and as he eases into this, I say eases into it, he moves from talking about the Father in verse 13, well, actually in verse 12, giving thanks to the Father, and then mentioning the Father in the first part of verse 13, or in all of verse 13, and then in verse 14, we shift to the Son. God the Son. And God the Son becomes therefore this unprecedented, no comparison, eternal celebrity. His celebrityship. People are big on celebrityship. Celebrities come and go. This is the ultimate celebrityship. This is the celebrity, Jesus Christ. And His celebrityship is based on the fact that He is the agent of the Father. His humanity was necessary because deity can't bear sins. Divine essence can't suffer. Divine essence is beyond suffering. But humanity can. So with the advent of the God-man, humanity was provided so that in His maturity, physically and spiritually, Jesus Christ bore the sins of the world. He is the agent of salvation. He came into this domain of darkness, into the devil's turf as a human, the God-man. He came into the devil's domain. The devil tried to bring Him down. He tried to snuff Him out at birth through that maniac Herod. And God had it all figured out. Take a vacation to Egypt. The Persian wise men bankrolled it. So they didn't have to go down there and live without anything. They brought those gifts. And so they spent some time in there and they were told to come back up out of Egypt. Christ did go out of country. He went to Egypt as a baby, as an infant, as a toddler, whatever. So comes back and grows up and lives in anonymity. And then steps into His public ministry. And immediately Satan tries to bring Him down. God lets Satan tempt Him. Couldn't say, well, He was all protected. Nobody ever bothered Him. And He had no pressures put upon His soul. Well, Satan did it for 40 days. And then gave Him the three deals. And Jesus was led of the Spirit to go right into that environment of temptation. Not the environments necessarily, it's just the Judean hostile desert with all its bad animals and how easy it is to get lost out there and be dead. So he went out there and he resisted Satan. And he resisted him under extreme hunger and thirst to his humanity. He won that battle. And throughout the course of his life on earth, he was tempted, tested in every way like we are. So that's, you got to be a celebrity right there. You never sinned? Not even once? No fear? No nothing? And he did it, and it wasn't a cakewalk. You know, if you were not able to sin and you were just somewhat of a robot, then it would be a cakewalk. So, and of course, God raised him from the dead is to indicate that this is the authentication of that it, his work on the cross was what it was accepted. He raised him up from the dead and seated him at his right hand. And we go on in verse 15, referring to the person of Jesus Christ, the God-man. He is the image of the invisible God. He is the articulation of the invisible God. We can't see the divine attributes. They're invisible. We learn about them. We know that there are these attributes we've gone over before. He is the image. He is the image. Again, he is who. Who is the image? Present active indicative keeps on being the icon. You got icons on your deal. He's the icon. He's the icon of the invisible God. The God, word invisible, of course, is an adjective with a definite article, aorotos. The invisible God. The firstborn. See, these are titles. These are his titles. People are big on titles, aren't they? He is in the invisible. He is the image of the invisible God. The prototokos, firstborn of all creation. All, and that means the created order of things. All things that fall within the category of ketesis, creation. Now, for by him all things were created. That obviously refers to his deity, exercising his deity. His deity was exercised at some point. For by him, preposition here is in, kind of like in an instrumental sense rather than the locative sense. So I give it the instrumental sense. For in him, for by him, excuse me, all things, definite article with the noun all. The all things were created. They received the action of this verb, hence the aorist passive indicative of the verb to create, ketizo. So where did everything come from? It came from the deity of the Son of God. That's where it came from, which obviously predated the existence of his humanity by however long. In the heavens. Heavens is plural. Now we have the locative sense of heaven. In the heavens, multiple. And on earth, upon the earth. Preposition epi, upon, with the article ge, that little word, ge, earth. Spelling it out even further. Visible and invisible. What can be seen and observable, what's observable, and what cannot be seen. It's not observable by any technology. Invisible. So visible again, horatos, and I was checking something out here. never mind. My thing here. Visible and invisible. Then this becomes questionable. Whether thrones, ite, whether thrones, thronos, that's the actual word for thrones, or translated dominions, kuriestes, which we have kurios, Lord, dominions. and or rulers. Ruler is arche. By the way, arche is the word for beginning of something. So it becomes also a word used for someone who is the head guy, the ruler. Or authorities. There's your exousia, which is word meaning authority. Paul adds, all things. The all things, with a definite article, have been created. Again, we have the same. We have, in this case, we have the perfect passive indicative. Existing results in the perfect tense. All things have been created through him, dia, without us. And for him, preposition eis. And autos. Paul further lines it all out, because there has been all these false notions put out about the Son of God, and he is before all things. He predated all things. He is before. Preposition pro means before all things. And in him, in his person, and again this relates to his deity, though obviously now that he is the God-man glorified, the total person is in view, and his deity, hold together, perfect active indicative. Everything holds together, right down to the atomic particle, everything holds together, soon estemi. This creation requires maintenance, if you will, or some sort of, whatever the best word is. It requires this oversight. You can't just create it and let it go. It will not sustain itself. There is this divine hidden factor of God holding everything together. We might attribute it to natural causes, but he holds it all together. It is directly his hands-on holding together everything. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. So this piles up here from defining the sphere of what he has created, defining the fact that who he is, that he stands as the head of creation. The firstborn is the term one. The celebrity status of Jesus Christ continues to be the focus through verse 22. It's important for you as a believer to see that the Son of God is the Father's agent. He's the one that executes this stuff. It's just the way it is. He is. In these verses, Christ's status is presented as the Father's agent in the creation of all that exists. He is his agent in salvation, with special emphasis on his humanity. Two, first, he is designated as being in the image of the invisible God. An image is an external thing. So image here is to be taken not as an approximate image, but as an exact image, as in our expressions, spitting image. He's a spitting image of his Father. I mean, he looks just like him, he acts like him, he thinks like him. Spitting image or identical twin, if that's helpful. He is identical in all respects, except now we have the externalization of the Son with his humanity. And now it's glorified. Image, then, is not an approximate image. It's a look-alike thing. The noun icon, let me switch the antonym, is used of a face on a coin. Matthew 22:20 and parallels. Caesar's face on a coin. And in Revelation, as a super image, artificial intelligence. The image of the beast, the worship of the beast system with its technological marvel of this new robotic android, whatever you want to call it, whatever the terms that we'll use, we'll just use AI, artificial intelligence, which technology is in full swing today, and with the passage of time, this will be pulled together and this image will be established in the tribulational temple yet to be erected. Anyway, it is used as the icon of the Antichrist, an image. In other words, it is going to be a spitting image of this guy. Not something that's a little crude, and yeah, I can see that this thing is just sort of, yeah, because you see them on TV, you've seen programs maybe, 60 Minutes had a program on artificial intelligence. This thing is going to ramp up until it is so darn lifelike, I believe, that the two people standing side by side, the real and the other, switch them around, and you'll have trouble picking it out. It'd just be a guess. You have a 50-50 chance. That's how realistic this thing's going to be when it's up and running in the middle of the tribulation. And this word is used in all those verses about that image. I think there's eight of them there, eight citations. In Romans 1:23, it's used in a context dealing with the rise of pagan idolatry after the flood on the planet. Why did they come up with what we would say these outlandish ideas? This absolute crazy, and these very intelligent people. Thank God we don't have any in our civilization. We're smarter than that. No, we're not. They exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God. Now, who did this? These certain individuals within civilizations devise these ideas and then sell them to the masses. This is the download of demonic concepts to individuals who channel this stuff. Really, we might think that people just thought it up on their own. They did not. They were under demon influence, direct demon influence. It's a major factor in human history that they download their ideologies, their concepts, and exchange the glory of the incorruptible God. God can't be corrupted, changed. God does not change. He does not degrade. He does not improve because he can improve because he's absolute perfection. That's that simple. For the image in the form of corruptible man. Idols are in human form, male and female. Aphrodite. That image that sits on that pedestal called the Statue of Liberty. It's not just a symbol. It's a representation that appeals to more of a Western look in the form of an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. These become objects of idolatrous reverence throughout civilization. Plants, everything. People wanted something they could see, that they could bow down to, burn incense to, etc., etc., etc. Some are little tiny icons, some are big statues like a Zeus sitting in the temple. This foreboding statue that's I don't know how many feet high. When they walked into the temple, you saw Zeus. Zeus was the first of all the gods in Greek mythology. So forth. This system was imported or exported all around the planet with the passage of time. And each nation adopted it and had their own variations within it. But it had a fountainhead. It had a source. It didn't spring up independently here and there so much as it came out of Babylon. And yes, other cultures have thrown away certain things, you know, and are less image prone, if you will, than other cultures. You know, some worship, you know, the elements, fire, wind, and so forth. Water, more of a kind of more esoteric maybe. But so anyway, this whole thing, Paul says, this is the background to the Gentile world. It was a case of mass rejection of God, the knowledge of God as viewed in the creation. That the creation, with all of its sophistication and all of its detail, speaks of what? A designer. An all-wise, powerful designer. They didn't like that, because it was a way to lead them to God. They didn't like that. So they started inventing these fictions. And these were they held a very powerful thing over people, as idolatry continues to flourish on the planet to this day in various cultures. But they're absolutely devoted to this. And yet all the Bible blasts setting up icons, images. And we shouldn't try. And the law of Moses started right off at the beginning in the Ten Commandments. Do not make graven images. Do not make these things. You degrade God. You cannot reduce Him to some figurine. It's not possible. It does not glorify His person. So don't do it. This was always a snare for the Jews. Because it has a powerful attraction to the STA. Superstition, ideas of this. And then, of course, you're born in a culture where you're inundated with it. And you're awful if you aren't subservient to it. And keeping up with it is a monumental task, if not impossible. Paul said to the Greeks on Mars Hill, where all the philosophers would gather and debate and see their latest mental inventions. He said, read his speech in Acts 17 on Mars Hill. Right, you can go to Greece now and visit the same spot. You can go right there. He said, I've noticed that you're very religious people. You've got icons to everything. You even have one to the unknown God. In case you just happen to leave one of these out and he's feeling bad about it and he's going to jump on your case, you have a monument with what we would say X-Files. This is the X we have found archaeologically. We found that. They found that. This is for the God or gods. We might have left out. We don't want to tick them off. And so, okay, we got those. And so Paul turns that in a beautiful way and says, I'm going to announce to you that God is, who's unknown to you. So he taught them about God, Jesus, His work, His resurrection. And a couple out of that, these intelligent crowd, a couple became believers. The rest of them started running around in circles and wondered that he was preaching two deities. Jesus is one deity and the other deity was resurrection. You know, locked in. Negative volition keeps you locked in. But the Colossians came out of that. So this is the degeneration of the Gentile world is not just a spiritual degeneration with the advent of idolatry and the development of idolatry in these systems. But it also led to moral decay. The idolatry and moral decay go hand in hand because it's all part of that same sewer. Okay? And he says that, you know, they violated the proper use of sex because a lot of the gods and goddesses, they made them in their own image. Well, that's real helpful. They made these gods and goddesses in their own image. They were killers and rapists and fornicators and all kinds of stuff. Oh, that's our God. You know? So they gave themselves over to the lusts of their hearts, sponsored by the sin nature, to impurity so that their bodies would be dishonored among them. Sexual license. Of all sorts and all kinds, running the whole gamut. That's a part of the idolatrous scene, which is not particularly pertinent here, just to note it. So this verse is a noun used in connection with pagan iconography. It is used of man being created in the image of God as well. 1 Corinthians 11:7, in a discussion of head hair. That the male is created in the image of God, and as such, he ought to have short hair. That's a sign of his authority. And that the woman ought to have, relatively speaking, long hair. That's a discussion of the long and short hair passage in the Bible. That's a pretty obvious passage. But it again is talking about he's created in the image of God. Adam wasn't a hippie. He didn't have dreadlocks. Well, period. I mean, yes, so it meant that in his lifetime he had to figure out a way to cut his hair. Because it's going to grow and grow long if you don't. 8, it is otherwise used of believers being transformed into the image of Christ. Through spiritual growth and spiritual development is what is commonly known Christ-like. Christ-like thinking. Christ-like behavior. With spiritual growth, we become like Christ. Now, there are pseudo-versions of that, quite obviously. Fundy legalists, you know, would be an example. But we all, with an unveiled face, this goes back to the story of Moses coming down from the mountain and being in that situation where he got an indirect hit with the glory of God on the mountain. That was such a nature that it permeated his epidermis, his skin, to such a degree that he came down with the mountain and his face was just aglow. Like looking into a strong flashlight. Beholding as in a mirror. You know what a mirror is? It reflects what's there. The glory of the Lord. Are being transformed into the same image from glory to glory, just as from the Lord the Spirit. Ultimately, all believers are going to be in the image of Christ. I don't mean we're all going to look alike. That's the externalization of it. We're all going to look alike. We'll still retain our gender and other certain features. Obviously, a mass improvement, even if you're very handsome and very attractive. It's going to be a tremendous improvement. But the important thing is we're going to be Christ-like. God can do nothing better than make us into that perfect image. In the Greek world, they talked about the perfect man. Body, intellect, the physical part. Hence in the statues, someone well-proportioned. They don't tend to show sloppy-looking people on there. They show the perfect man. Body, intellect, so forth. The complete man. So, this is the image that is spoken of here. And 3:18, Colossians 3:10. And how many times have you lied to another believer? You don't have to tell me. It's just a point. Verse 9. Do not lie to one another. Tell a lie. Tell a fib. Whatever you want to call it. Do not lie to one another, since you laid aside the old self with its evil practices. When did you do that? When you got saved, the STA was isolated. He's going back to that point where we have a new beginning. And I put on the new self, who is being renewed, intake of doctrine, to a true knowledge according to the image of the one who created him. Once it is translated shadow in connection with the shadow theology of the tabernacle. 10. Here and in 2 Corinthians 4:4, it is used of Christ, who is the exact representation of God. Thank you. He talks about our gospel being veiled and hidden to the general cosmos and all those people who are perishing in that kingdom of darkness. In whose case, the God of this world, Satan's busy, always has been, has blinded the minds of the unbelieving. He keeps them in a blind state. Of course, it's fed and fostered by their own negative volition. But nevertheless, he keeps them distracted with false ideologies, religions, concepts, pseudoscience, evolution. It's respectable in all the universities and all the public schools, is it not? And it's a joke. It is a farce. It is a logical farce that out of nothing, an explosion occurred. And out of an explosion, order occurred. And over billions of years, one cell got going. And life started in the water. And some of it crawled up on the ground and developed lungs and then flew off. I mean, it's nuts. How has this got anything over what the pagans came up with? In their pagan cosmologies. A cosmology is doctrine of cosmos and origin. Where's an advantage over that? Well, we couldn't go back and believe the pagan stuff and all the little goofy stuff they were sold all the sophisticated people and all the dumb and all the people on the planet. So we got to come up with something and we'll call it science. And libraries are filled with it. And people recant it or don't recant it. They recite it. They're into it. And it blows away all logic. Explosions don't result in order. You cannot blow up a junkyard and get cars as a result. Or anything. Even given time. This is what they're taught. Because they don't want God in their thinking, so it's a convenient atheistic out. Anyway. I didn't read all that. So they might not see the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ. What we see clearly. Who is the image of God? He is the exact image. He is an exact replica. Except the only difference is he has a body. A humanity that he has that none of the other members of the Trinity have in that sense. A body he picked up under the normal circumstances of being born in of a woman. A regular body. Oh yeah, it's been changed into a resurrection body. But hey, it had a start there. And it underwent death, physical. See? That's our celebrity. He overcame death. He defeated sin on the cross so that God is completely satisfied that all sins have gone to court and been judged, so you can have forgiveness if you just do one thing, believe or rebound. So first he is designated in the celebrityship of Jesus Christ as in the image of the invisible God. As we know today, people pick a lot of celebrities. Some of them are real pathetic. And humanly speaking, some are okay, but they're just humans. You know, this is celebrity, and this celebrity, and people want to be like them, God help them. They project that they think, I'd like to be like that. Oh, wouldn't that be great? And their celebrity ship comes, fades, goes, and they have another group of them. And wow, 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 wow. Jesus, and of course when the Antichrist comes, he's going to be a super celebrity for a while, a short while. Until he's smashed by this celebrity, Jesus Christ. Yeah, you can be impressed what people can physically do, how well they can sing, how far they can jump, and all that stuff. But we're going to deal with the celebrityship of Jesus Christ and continue to deal with it in our next session. Here he is in the precise image of the invisible God. Thank you, Father, for the time together. May God the Holy Spirit enlighten us in Christ's name. Amen.